House Committee on Judiciary's Wednesday meeting. Let me start by just giving you a general heads up. We are not going to be working House Bill 2877 today. That has been carried onto the agenda tomorrow when we should have amendments ready for discussion tomorrow. And the same thing applies to Senate Bill 120, which will be on Thursday's agenda. With that in mind, we'll start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 166. Open a public hearing. We'll bring up Senator Peter Courtney, the illustrious graduate from Boston University Law School.
Because it was bad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator from District 17, Salem Kaiser. I thought the good representative from Dallas, Monmouth, Independence, and Paloma would come and speak with me on this. This little bill, Mr. Chair, I have a rule about appearing before committee, so I'm sort of nervous. This is one of those bills where I introduced it for somebody.
What's going on?
I introduced this bill for somebody, and they didn't show up, so I decided to work the bill anyway. And I got blown up in the Senate Judiciary Committee over this bill as it was originally written, because it would have allowed a cause of action if someone intentionally went out and killed your dog and you were traumatized over it. You could have a cause of action now in some states for special damages and emotional trauma and things. Well, that didn't go over very well with the insurance industry, the cattle association, the veterinarians. So what we did, though, is we found out that there were some things out there that could be done in this little bill. There's also, it was a little problem with a judge in Newport over this bill, who was very upset with the attorney, I guess, in Walport and Newport, who asked me to introduce the bill. And I don't know what that's all about. I still don't know what it's all about. Apparently, right now, we had a very vague description of what a bite was. And if you have the A. and Gross bill, you'll see a bite that causes a break in the skin. That is much more specific in terms of a cause of action or how the law deals with it. And so that was put in there with no dissent. In fact, that was necessary, Mr. Chair, and members of the Judiciary Committee, to clarify that. Then we have a little issue with rabies. Now, rabies is really very serious stuff. And it says that a dog that has permanent canine teeth or that is 6 months of age or older must be inoculated. Now, the reason that's in there is, and I never knew this, a lot of people they have puppies, and they think they got to go out and have the dog, a little puppy, with rabies shots right away. The veterinarians came in and said it is not good. It is not good for puppies to have a rabies shot before they're 6 months old or they show real teeth. It's just not good for them. So that was to put in there to make sure that people don't get cited, do not get cited if they have a dog under 6 months of old that hasn't had a rabies shot yet. So this bill became Representative Shirley.
I'm with you.
Okay, because he wants to do something in this bill too. That's the reason I'm keying on him. So that was put in here for that as well. And so that's basically some of the things that the bill did. And then it came out with no dissent. It had the veterinarians on board. The insurance industry was all right with the Cattlemen's Association. I understand, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Learned and High Counsel, Andrea or Hartel, about this, but they're going to use this vehicle to do something else by an individual who is sitting with this august committee. And, Mr. Chair, I'm happy. Whatever you do with this bill, I'm happy. I mean that, Mr. Chair, whatever you do. So is that okay, what I did right now?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetter.
Do I take that then to mean that my dog DNA amendments are going to get into this bill?
You know, I just want to say again how much I appreciate all these pet bills.
Well, wait. I got snookered. I got snookered. I didn't. I know what you're thinking, so isn't someone over here thinking the same thing as she said that to me, but it just happens in life. You know, there's a time and place, and when the time's hot, it's hot, and this is that time.
So
Senator, could you refresh my recollection? Didn't you bring your dog onto the floor of the Senate last session?
I did, but, you know, listen, don't, listen. I did do that last session. I held her in my arms as I carried a bill. Her name is Yoda.
Yoda?
Yoda. Star Wars. See, that's my generation. Young, my kids. Yoda is a Star Wars figure with big ears. My dog has big ears. So one of my sons said, let's
cute
call him Yoda.
Cute dog it is.
Mm. Mine's cute.
But right. I did. But it was a serious bill, if you want to know about it.
No,
it
no,
very,
no, I don't.
Okay,
don't.
Okay. Well,
I remember
it was a very
from
serious
last
bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, I thought this bill was dead over in the Senate. I didn't know it was still alive because I'd like to amend on to this bill. Because you know that I have another dog bill myself that
oh,
you
God.
Co-sponsored. Make them stop.
Well, go to work, sir. Chair Williams, Representative Walker, the bill isn't dead. Or it wouldn't be here.
I know.
So if you're telling me that the chair has told you it's dead, then it's dead. He didn't tell me it was dead.
No, 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 Senator. I thought it was dead over there. But
does anybody have aspirin?
The question that I have for you, Senator, is one of the things that I wanted to do this session was
God.
My dog got bit by a big dog. My dog's name is Spike, and he's a 10-pound Yorkie toy poodle mix. And he got bit by a big dog in his eye, and now he's blind in one eye. There is no cause of action against the owner of the dog that bit my dog.
Oh, but I need aspirin.
But we did have a discussion, and they did pay the vet bills. But they're not required to. Is that correct, Senator?
Mr. Chair Williams, I believe that's correct. And as far as Spike's eye is concerned, you're just going to have to live with that because that was the original bill. And I know that's traumatic to say, but what am I going to tell you? The original bill would have helped Spike in his eye. But that all came out of the original bill. So
yeah.
That would have helped the eye.
Okay.
So I don't know what else. That's probably why you thought the bill was dead.
As fun as this has been.
I'm just trying to answer.
No, I appreciate it.
I'm not.
I think we've got a good idea of where we're headed. Do we have more questions for Senator Courtney?
Can I ask?
You may.
Representative Shetterly, what did you ask me about this bill?
Earlier?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I asked Senator Courtney if he minded, the A4 amendments. I was just letting him know that we were going to amend the A4 amendments to put my pet trust bill attached this one. So that was all. It wasn't related to the substance of the bill is coming over from the Senate.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you.
I have now. I'd like to bring forward Scott Beckstead from Lincoln County.
It's okay. I was just about to say I haven't gotten a chance to get a word in edgewise. The A4s, we're making copies of those right now. They didn't get into your packet, so
okay.
That those are the A4s come from Representative Shetterly.
In committee, I want you to relax because it's my intention to potentially not work this bill today if there's reservations on the part of the committee to get an opportunity to digest the amendments. Mr. Beckstead, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Scott Beckstead. And I am a lawyer. I have a practice in Waldport, and I also have an office in Newport. And I am here to speak up for the dogs of the world today. But lest you get the idea that I'm extreme in my perspective, I'll let you know that personal injury work is a substantial part of my practice, and I do represent people who have been injured by dogs. And I'm very, very much aware of the tremendous harm that the dogs can and do cause. Nevertheless, I was, I guess, the original author of Senate Bill 166, and with respect to the part that of the bill that deals with how courts and public bodies deal with dogs who are accused of biting, my concern, of course, was to protect dog owners and their animals from a process that could be unfair and arbitrary. Now I have looked at the proposed changes that have been advanced by Judge Tom Bramford, who, as I understand it, is probably the primary opponent of the bill. And I don't have a problem with a great number of his changes. I believe that people who flout the law and who do not take steps to protect the public from their dogs should be held criminally liable. Whether that's through the imposition of a fine or whether that's through the imposition of jail time, I'm all for it. I think that it makes sense to add the word exclusively to the part of the bill dealing with conduct that takes place on premises occupied by the keeper of the dog. That's a change that makes sense to me. What I do oppose is throwing in the words menacing and chasing with the words biting, because I think that those are terms that are so vague and so subjective that it again opens the process up to an arbitrary and potentially unfair nature. What may be menacing to one person may be playful conduct, normal canine conduct to another. And what I fear is that a person who has an unreasonable fear of dogs might claim that a dog was menacing them when, in fact, it was completely harmless conduct. The other language that I have to bring to your attention is section six that deals with a special statutory proceeding. I did not write that language. I don't understand that language. I don't know how it got in there. And I have no strong feeling one way or the other about it. I know Judge Branford doesn't like it, and for purposes of seeing this bill passed, I don't object to that language being taken out. I think what I wanted to see when I first wrote this language was I want judges to apply the existing statutory criteria that's already in the statutes before ordering a dog put to death. And if they order a dog put to death, they should issue written findings on those criteria, and the dog owner should have a chance to appeal. That's all I was really aiming to accomplish here. And so to the extent that the Judge Branford's proposed changes support or provide helpful modifications to that basic scheme, then I support that. To the extent that they controvert that basic scheme, I would be opposed to it. Again, all I'm trying to do is give dogs who are accused of misconduct some level of protection from arbitrary or unfair decisions. The part of the bill that deals with rabies, this actually stemmed from a case that I actually worked on, where a fellow was cited for an alleged bite that occurred by his four-month-old puppy. The bite did not break the skin, and the puppy was too young to be inoculated against rabies, and yet this person was both cited and fined for not having his dog vaccinated against rabies. Technically, any person who has a newborn litter of puppies is in violation of the law. And what I wanted to do was bring the rabies inoculation portion of the statute in alignment with the licensing portion of the statutes that says basically once a dog is 6 months old, it has to be licensed. And that seems to make sense to me that if a dog is 6 months old and able to be vaccinated for rabies, then that's when the law should take effect. Now, I will tell you also that another part of my practice is writing wills and trusts for people. And a lot of people come to me because they know that I am an animal advocate and because they know how I feel about animals, and they come to me because they want to make sure that their animals are cared for after their death. So I'm very excited to see the pet trust amendment added to this bill, and I wholeheartedly support it, and I think that that's going to give a lot of peace of mind to people who care about their animals, particularly elderly people who are setting up their estate plans and who want to make sure that if they should happen to pass, that their animals remain taken care of. So that's all I have, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Beckstead. Are there questions for Mr. Beckstead?
Thank you.
I'd now like to bring up Sharon Harmon. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. If you're thinking this sounds familiar, you've heard about this in the previous session. I worked with Judge Branford with the original language to make it a little more pet-friendly, a little more understandable, a little more consideration giving to the factors that may be involved when a dog bites someone. We like Senate Bill 166 with a couple of little reservations. It seems odd that I'm here today to tell you I support a bill where there's the word killed in here so many more times than I'm comfortable with. But what we're talking about with Senate Bill 166 is what happens to people and dogs when things go awry. The recent situation in San Francisco has made everybody a little nervous about what some members of our canine community can do, both for the to other people, but to their reputation as companion animals. And I think it makes Senate Bill 166 even more timely today that we address this. Overriding issue is that we want to see animals be given or consideration given to the options before death is chosen. We don't want to see dogs killed as a punishment for the owner. There are options for many animals, but I'm not here today to tell you there are no bad dogs. There are. There are bad owners, there are bad dogs, and there's a place in society, and there's a society that cannot take the risk of substantial bodily harm to people from dogs that we've simply lost. We've simply lost, either through abuse, neglect, bad breeding. But I'm not here today to tell you that there are no bad dogs. And Senate Bill 166 provides for the destruction of animals or of dogs that are truly a danger, but I think it also adds some level of assurance to pet owners that they will be told why, that all those reasons that an animal, why those options didn't work, be put in writing. And I think that's reasonable to ask a court to simply define why they chose not to rehome the dog, why they chose not to impose other restrictions, and to spell it out. We would hope that the intent is not to punish the owner by killing their pet. And I don't believe our court system does that. I don't believe the authors and the other people to testify in this bill have that in mind. We just don't want to see that to be the practice. One other point, the term menacing kind of makes me nervous. And I'll tell you why. I was in the lobby of our shelter yesterday. I have a 95-pound German Shepherd. Comes to work with me every day. She comes bounding across the lobby and barks at one of my staff. And the person next to me says, "Is your dog always that aggressive?" Now, here's what happened. Dog runs up, does a play bow, you know, rear end up in the air, paws down, barks at him, rolls over on her back, says, "Scratch my belly." The person next to me is an architect. They're an educated person. They have pets, and yet they interpreted that as aggressive behavior. So what is menacing? Is it the eye of the beholder? We would not. We are concerned that animals or dogs could be destroyed for showing simple behavior that gets misinterpreted. So absent a definition, you know, we would have to look to what's menacing and with respect to people. We kicked around a definition of menacing yesterday, and I tell you, we just could not come up with something that didn't allow for, it just didn't work. But the conversation needs to continue. We're willing to let menacing give it a try for until the next session and see how it is interpreted in the courts and what kind of case law gets set down. But it's a part that we're cautious about. What is menacing? What's normal dog behavior? There may be normal dog behavior that is truly menacing. If you look at a Fila Brasileiro, if you look at a Tibetan Mastiff, you're looking at breed characteristic behavior that is aggressive, and that is menacing. But when you look at a playful German Shepherd bounding across the floor and play bowing in front of someone, it's not menacing, but the eye of the beholder may lead to the destruction of the dog. We support the A5 amendments that are here. So many things have happened with this bill. You're right. It's hard to keep track of them all. And if in the wisdom of this committee, it's decided to adopt the pet trust language, we are certainly all for it, and would like to see that bit of language be added to Oregon's statutes. Thank you for listening this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Harmon. Are there questions for Ms. Harmon? Thank you. Judge Tom Branford. Welcome, Your Honor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for giving me a chance to speak here this morning. Let me start with this. I'd like to add to what Ms. Harmon just said. Before I testified at the Senate 3 months ago on this bill, I looked up on the Internet some stuff following the death of the woman in San Francisco. There's an article here in Newsday written by Kathy Guillermo, who's a writer for People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, And in that, she's describing the San Francisco incident and some others. And what was really shocking was, she quotes in her article, "Unfortunately for the dogs and for the people who happen to live near them, many breeders of pit bulls and other powerful dogs are attracted to the macho image and even foster aggression in the dogs rather than working to socialize them." And here's a sentence that just killed me. "The kind of dogs that were involved in the killing of the woman are called Presa Canarios," if I mispronounce that. She says, "Demand for Presa Canarios has skyrocketed since Whipple's death." So that should stagger anybody with a conscience. That's the sort of problem we're trying to cope with in the court. I support Ms. Chartel was involved in drafting these the A5 amendments, and I like all of them. Very well done, and certainly support those. I had a couple other comments I wanted to make. First of all, the whole intent behind this starting 2 years ago, actually 3 years ago when I started this the ball rolling, was the whole idea is to protect people because the statutes we had for 30 years didn't come close. With regard to chasing and menacing, those words are in the existing statutes. They're in the penalty provision, in the 990 provision, in the existing statute about dog as a public nuisance. But in the definition of a public nuisance, it talks about biting a person or chasing a person. And I thought to be consistent, when they talk about menacing in the penalty provision, it should be inserted in the definition of what is a public nuisance. And that's why I simply suggested adding the word in the other part of the statute. Menacing is defined in criminal law to be intentionally placing another person in fear of imminent bodily injury. That's the sort of conduct that was intended to be governed initially when the change was made. My argument, I sent each of you a letter here a couple weeks ago, is that I have seen cases where people escaped being bitten by dogs with a history of aggressive biting behavior only because, in one case, it was a woman jogging in Toledo. She escaped getting bitten because somebody happened to come by in a car and she was able to jump in the car. Well, the dogs had bitten before. They were intending to bite her, and that's the sort of conduct that the word menacing and chasing is intended to encompass. Another person was a postal carrier who got in a car that somebody brought in the driveway as a dog was coming across. So, I mean, those are the dog is no less dangerous just because the person happens to be real lucky to avoid a bite. And I'm certainly willing to look at trying to define that in the future if you want, but again, it's a judgment call, and judges do that all day long regarding people and everything else, and I don't think any judge is going to arbitrarily or capriciously or in bad faith interpret typical canine behavior to be menacing. with regard to the letter, I had two sections, one called criminal liability. I may have misread the text that I had of the proposed bill. As long as what is currently on the table would not delete the Class C misdemeanor, then I'm thrilled. If it does, I'd ask you to retain that. The Class C misdemeanor is intended for a person who has twice in their life had a person, had a dog who has bitten somebody else. After two times, the intent is to give a court the authority to put the person on probation and require compliance with threat of jail for the person if there's noncompliance. What I didn't see, and Ms. Chartel, maybe I should ask you this question, what I call the great anomaly about giving the defendant the choice of which court to go to, I didn't see in the A5 amendments something that deleted reference to a special statutory court. If that goes bye-bye, that's great. But my point is that the only time a circuit court gets these cases is if there is a prosecution for dog as a public nuisance initiated, and the judge should be able to handle the whole ball of wax and not end up having two different trials. My only other comment is it is very common for people who are irresponsible owners and generally irresponsible people in society anyway not to come to court, whether it's a criminal charge or a dog as a charge or a traffic ticket. People don't show up. I support the existing statutory criteria that a court is supposed to consider before ordering euthanasia of a dog. Ms. Harmon and I were involved in helping compose that language 2 years ago. My only comment is that if the person doesn't show up, if there's a factor the court can't consider because the person didn't come to court to allow the court to do that, the finding shouldn't be deficient. So if there is information in a police report that governs, that covers one or more of the criteria that a court is to consider before ordering euthanasia, that alone should be enough. The statutes, existing statutes say the court doesn't have to make all the findings, but is simply to focus on these and to consider them before making a decision. And I think the findings should not be held to be deficient if the person, the owner, the keeper, has not come to court to tell you what the other factors are. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Branford. Are there questions for His Honor, Representative Vicki Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, can you answer the question for me about whether people currently have a cause of action against someone for harming their animal?
I don't know that because I haven't seen somebody do that. There may be, but I don't know. The one, Representative Walker, the one comment I thought of when you said that is that if there were a charge filed against the keeper of that dog for dog as a public nuisance, for example, dog as a public nuisance also encompasses a dog trespassing on your property. If there is a loss sustained, a court can order restitution in a dog bite case, and I've done that before in a dog bite where there's restitution ordered to the owner. The bites for which I've ordered restitution have been for people, but there's no prohibition on restitution for a pet. I have a good friend, in fact, the lady who's in charge of the 4-H program in Lincoln County, her dog was almost killed, and her dog was an award winner at state festival. And that dog was almost killed by a neighbor dog that jumped through a fence and as I say, darn near killed it. And it was just devastating. And there was no charge filed in that incident, but it's one similar to what you're dealing with. And I believe restitution could be ordered, but again, it would take the filing of a charge to enable the court to order that.
Further questions for His Honor?
Oh, and may I, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Another comment. There may not be a specific cause of action, but there is small claims jurisdiction, and there may not be an established cause of action, but if you could show that an owner had let a dog run at large or had let it trespass on your property, that would be a statutory violation, and I would think would be sufficient basis to file a small claims to recover that money. So you would have those two options, one with the assistance of a citation to circuit court, the other would be filing a small claims action.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Judge, I thought that was available to folks as well. I just didn't think the statute was very clear, and that's why I had a bill introduced to take care of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Cheryl Walker.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. I just had a comment in regard to menaces. I don't really have a question of the judge, so that's all right.
You said Wilson, it's Williams, but that's
excuse
all right.
Me.
Just pointing that out.
I'm on Chair Wilson's committee, another committee.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just giving you a hard time. Just kidding. So your questions have been answered?
My questions have been answered. I just had a comment about menacing.
Okay. Are there further questions for the judge? Thank you very much,
Thank you,
Your Honor. I want to call up Pete Test and Lana Butterfield, who have asked to also speak on the bill. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, members of the committee, and here representing Safeco Insurance Companies. We have no problem with the bill as it is written now and with dash A4 and dash A5, but we wanted to put on the record that we would be opposed to putting back the original language of the bill because we did oppose that over in the Senate.
Thank you. Mr. Test.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm Pete Test, Associate Director of Government Affairs for Oregon Farm Bureau. We worked with several other ag groups to get the bill to the port the way it is now from the Senate and support it as it came to you. Also, I reviewed the dash A4 amendments, and we have no problems with those. I won't speak for the other groups. If there are A5s, I have not seen them or the other amendments, and I would like to, when I have the opportunity to see them, I may want to comment or make some comments again later on them.
We'll be happy to get you a copy of the A5 amendments. My guess is, are they sitting over on the, could you give a copy to Mr. Test? We want to ask you to, we want to ask you to comment on them now, Pete. But you'll be, we'll be pleased to take comments from you later. Are there any questions for either of these two? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 166? Hearing none, we're going to close the public hearing. The chair's intention, the judge mentioned a couple of additional issues with respect to the A5s. I'm going to ask Andrea to work with the parties. I think we have this bill scheduled on Friday's agenda for a possible work session. So you have both the A4 and the A5 Amendments Committee in front of you that you'll want to consider before work session. There'll probably be an A6 that incorporates some of the issues that I think were raised in the hearing today. If you have particular opinions, you might wish to speak to counsel about that while those amendments are being prepared. Representative Vicki Walker.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just want to be included in that discussion because I'm going to take a look at my bill and see if there's anything at all we can talk about and add on to this.
Take your shot. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I just, for Andrew, maybe a note, next time we bring this up, subsection 6 on page 6, it's proposed in Judge Brantford's amendments and letter to be deleted, but it refers to an election by the dog owner to have the dog's fate determined in a special statutory proceeding. I'd like to know what that, I mean, does that refer to something somewhere else in the statute? What is a special statutory proceeding?
Okay. And my understanding is that that Mr. Beckwith, a proponent of the bill, isn't sure how that language got in there either. So
that's the one, that's the language you was talking about? Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
Chair Williams?
Yes, Representative Cheryl Walker.
I would just like, the comment I was considering making was the menaces. I have a lot of problem with that. I always keep large dogs. And a lot of people, I have bull mastiffs, and one of my bull mastiffs weighs 185 pounds. And a lot of people think...
I guess you do keep... I'm a large guy, Representative Walker, and that's a large dog.
That's a large dog, yes. And the other two are not quite that large. I have three of them. And a lot of people consider my dogs to be menacing. I mean, when they come to my gate, and the whole idea is they guard my 43 acres. That's why I have those dogs. But once someone comes inside the gates, my dog would never hurt them. Once I let them in, there's no problem. But I've had people say, your dogs are so menacing. And I think that it's a lot of perception. I think there was one person who testified that sometimes people think that if a dog is just looking at them or barking, my dogs have docked tails, so they can't tell whether they're friendly with a tail or not. So I think we really need to be careful with the menacing aspect of this, so I'd just like to make that comment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill.
Just to point out to Representative Cheryl Walker that if you look in Section 7 on page 4, the declaration of nuisance here relates to where Judge Brantford would put menacing in the Dash 5 amendments. Refers to premises other than premises occupied by the keeper of the dog. So your dogs can be as menacing as they want to somebody who comes onto your property. I think this addresses what they do when they're off the premises.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly.
Although, could we have a candidates going door-to-door exception?
I suspect you don't get much door-to-door, Representative Walker.
Get any door-to-door.
Yeah,
Representative, that's why you carry dog bones in your pocket when you go door-to-door.
I buy 10 pounds
never
of dog
home
bones
without them.
When I go door-to-door.
Now the
I've got past every
out.
Dog.
Make sure that shows up on your forms that you file with the Secretary of State. Okay.
Can you break them in halves?
Okay, good. Well, again, colleagues, I'd encourage you to share your comments with Ms. Chartel, who's going to be responsible for trying to work people together on this bill. We're now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 647 and ask Senator Brown to come forward.
always a pleasure to see you. We were graced by Senator Courtney earlier, and I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to see you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm not sure I can be as funny as Senator Courtney was this morning. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. Thank you very much for giving this important issue a hearing. Just so you know, I have no... how can I say this? I have no passion or no, I'm not dying for this issue, but I just think it's really important. I introduced this bill as the result of a news clip that I saw one of the news reporters showed. And what they did basically is they took their reporter and the reporter went dumpster diving. As a result of the dumpster diving, the reporter was able to come up with an extensive amount of people's personal financial information, and it's a problem, frankly, all over the state. Last session, we took the defensive approach and made the crime of identity theft, and we put stiff penalties on that particular crime. This legislation addresses the core of the problem in order to prevent it in the first place. Identity theft and check fraud have increased dramatically over the last couple of years in Oregon. I think it's very interesting because bank robberies are going down. This bill would require certain businesses to shred or delete personal financial information on customers or employees before disposing of the information. I read the language of the bill. Someone raised the issue of whether it would apply from a business-to-business transfer. The bill clearly says dispose of records. I don't believe it would apply if a business were simply transferring records from one part of their company to another or between companies. Personal information would include medical histories, financial account numbers, tax return data, or any information that is associated with that a particular individual. A failure to shred information would constitute an unlawful trade practice and allow a civil cause of action for a damaged consumer. Colleagues, we've had two work groups on this issue with a variety of different folks. We discussed whether or not the Unlawful Trade Practices Act was an appropriate penalty. I simply just left it in there. It seemed to be more effective than requiring, for example, DCBS to go after the particular business and impose a fine. Other than that, there are a substantial amount of amendments. I have no problem with any of the amendments that have been introduced. The A2s are fine. The A3s are fine. The A4s are fine. The A5s, I believe, are actually mine, and as part of a work group suggestion from one of the members, they said, why didn't you have the folks that do payday loans and title lenders covered by the bill? And I said, great idea. So that's the dash five. Public bodies were originally in the first draft or the first version of the bill. The first work group talked about that and took out public bodies. First of all, my understanding is they're covered by rule, and apparently there is some difficulty with the Public Records Act regarding that issue. OHSU, however, is covered by the bill, and what's Jeff's last name? Former representative?
Gilmore.
Representative Gilmore, if you're out there, OHSU would be covered by the bill, so that'll probably give him a heart attack, and that's according to legislative counsel. I don't think I have anything else to add. I would be happy to answer any questions. I do think there's a plethora of folks behind me that are willing to offer helpful criticisms or comments about the bill.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Are there questions for Senator Brown? Why don't we, Representative Shetterly and then Representative Vicki Walker. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you know, this comes colloquially to us as the shredding bill. But I see in Section 2 that there are methods beyond shredding that are authorized. And I guess we have in Dallas the disposal company provides a confidential recycling service. I mean, we've got two bins in my office. One is regular recycling. Mm-hmm. One is confidential. And we put client-related documents in the confidential, and they take that out, so they tell us, they charge us for it, so I assume they do, and I know the guy that runs the company, and I believe him, and you know, they dispose of it directly into a shredder from this, you know, it's a regular garbage kind of collector, I assume that would be an approved method of disposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, as I read the bill, I think it would. You're taking actions that I reasonably believe that no unauthorized person would have access to the information. Basically, the bill provides for a good faith clause. I'm also pleased to see that you are recycling. Very good.
Further questions? Representative Vicki Walker and then Representative Cheryl Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All I have in my file are the A2 and the A3. So I'm asking where the A4s and A5s are coming around. No.
I think everybody has them except for her.
Wait a minute. Here. I found the other pile. There they are.
Okay. Representative Cheryl Walker.
Thank you, Chair Williams. I would like to thank you, Senator Brown, for doing this. I have been working a lot in the last 3 months on identity theft. It was driven home very personally when my son and daughter-in-law had their identity stolen in Portland. And it's very disturbing when you get involved in this as to what happens and what's going on. I would just like to note for the record that in the last year in Portland alone, those crimes have gone up 58%. And at this point in the last 3 months in the investigation, which, by the way, my son had to undertake the investigation because the crime has occurred over the Tri-Counties area and no jurisdiction wanted to take responsibility for it, so basically kind of got put aside, they now have connected 7 people. One is actually going to plead guilty tomorrow. But they just arrested someone day before yesterday on a voluntary search on a stop for OSP. So this thing is very big and very widespread, and unfortunately when they tried to pursue postal fraud, because that's where it had begun, was with the theft of a bank statement, which you always put your account number on your check when you pay your bills, so they got all the account numbers. Unfortunately, the Postal Department is receiving 60 of these every week, and they can't prosecute, so consequently they're cutting off at $20,000. So until the offense reaches $20,000, they aren't even doing anything there. So I think we have a bigger problem, and I think this is going a long ways to help alleviate some of that. If we can stop the source of information, I think we will stop the crime a lot. So thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I agree. This bill is intended to prevent the crime. And for those of us who have names that are used by many, it's a huge problem. Speaking of a Catherine Brown who had a Catherine Brown in her church, and I know there's a Kay Brown working for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, it's a huge problem. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to follow up. It doesn't even have to be a very common
name. No.
My son, I have 2 sons, and they're the only ones that have that name in Oregon. Their
wow.
name is not Walker, but they're the only ones that have the name in Oregon. So someone took their name.
Further questions for the good senator? Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I guess the question I have is the definition of medical business, and that's any business, any person, and of course I understand under Chapter 174, I think that means business too, but then in the course of business possesses information relating to an individual's physical or mental health. And it's not so much a quibble with this as being clear as to who's covered by this. I don't handle many, but occasionally clients come in and we'll do a personal injury case on one side or the other, and so we I would say in the regular course in my office probably possess medical records. Schools I would expect probably would have medical records in files. It would be helpful perhaps to clarify the definition of this. I imagine there are lots of businesses that possess medical records that wouldn't consider themselves medical businesses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I would have no objection if that were clarified. I don't have a problem with that. Mr. Chair, I know that Ms. Leavitt is in the back of the room representing the credit unions, and she has an amendment that is not yet complete that would provide that financial institutions that comply with the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act would not be covered by the bill. I don't have an objection to that either, Mr. Chair. So, thank you. I appreciate you tackling this very important issue.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Further questions?
we'll let you get back to your business in the Senate.
Thank you.
I'd like to now call Paul Cosgrove, Dave Fiskum, and Joe Bell forward. If that's the first three on the list. All having signed up carefully as against unless amended. So that's always a...
Unless they get their way.
Why don't we start with you, Paul?
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove representing Nationwide Insurance. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And I'm going to mention things that I've spoken with Senator Brown about. Nationwide Insurance is one of those medical businesses, not that we initially identified ourselves as such, but Nationwide is a property casualty carrier that in the course of handling claims, in particular personal injury claims, comes into possession of lots of medical information. And so we think under the broad definition of medical business, that probably scoops in almost all property casualty carriers. I also agree that I think my law office is probably a medical business under this definition, although we do not do a lot of work in that area. We are also in possession of medical records. My concern, however, is not so much with the substance of the bill, although I think that definition is awfully broad, because most of my client, Nationwide Insurance and my financial institution clients, take great pains and, in fact, institute procedures to deal with personal information that is very similar to what's in the bill, and, in fact, we are required to do so under federal law and our regulatory agencies. My greater concern is about the penalty and enforcement provisions in Section 3. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act was adopted in Oregon many years ago to deal with things like deceptive advertising, bait and switch, misleading or not full disclosure to consumers who are purchasing goods and services. And as such, it has a very interesting level of liability. You are liable under that act for a willful act, which we would normally think it means an intentional and knowing act, except the statute defines willful to be negligent, knew or should have known. And the Act, because of the topics it covers, deceptive trade practices and misleading information, also has a minimum statutory damages that you're liable for if there's any ascertainable loss. And there have been cases that having a consumer have to use a stamp in order to mail a letter of complaint is an ascertainable loss. That makes the party, a prevailing party, subject to attorney's fees costs as well as punitive damages in the case where they are willful, which again, in this case, is negligent or can be negligent. Our concern is that to the extent there are problems in this area with regulated industries like insurers and other financial institutions, our regulatory agencies, which in this state are mostly housed in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, both the Insurance Division and the Division of Corporate and Financial Institutions and Corporate Securities, I think is their current name, have the ability, in fact, are regularly monitoring us for compliance with Gramm-Leach-Bliley, the new Federal Privacy Act. They have the ability, if they find that there are standards that this legislature wants to adopt in addition to those, they also have the ability to enforce those on us in a systematic way so that all the problems are taken care of. And it takes us out of what we think is an inappropriate use of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for something it really wasn't intended to do. I'd like to give you the example that's been used by one of my colleagues in discussions about this bill of a negligent act that I think would create liability under the bill as written and subject us to unlawful trade practices liability. It happens to be a financial institution's example. It's a financial institution that does shred its records, but because some of those records got wet at one point in the kind of shredding process, a book of checks fell through the shredder and came through unshredded. That shredding material was sold to a consumer products mail order house to use as packing material instead of styrofoam pellets. And this person's checkbook from New Jersey showed up in a box of China in California. When the consumer in California opened the box of China, she called the owner of the account in New Jersey and said, "Did you mean to send me your checkbook?" And of course she did not. Now clearly, that was not an intentional act, and clearly that was something where the institution probably did a pretty good job, or at least it attempted to do a good job shredding the records. But the mistakes, in other words, do happen, and with unlawful trade practices, mistakes can be the basis for liability and individual consumer lawsuits that we think would be inappropriate. We think the enforcement should go back to the agencies that enforce the other rules on our institutions. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hold on questions for Mr. Cosgrove until we've allowed Mr. Fiskum and Joe Bell to testify. Mr. Fiskum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Dave Fiskum, representing Providence Health System, where we operate hospitals and other facilities in Portland, Milwaukee, Seaside, Hood River, Medford, Mount Angel. I may have missed a city, but you get the picture. We're a big system with lots of medical records. I want to thank Senator Brown, first of all, for her willingness along the way to listen to our expressions of interest and concern on this bill. In general, I think we believe our current practices are adequate to protect the privacy of our patients and their records. We do have a variety of federal laws and rules that we already deal with in a way that we would suggest makes this bill unnecessary. At the same time, we're pleased to work with you and others to produce a better bill if that's possible. In conversations with Senator Brown, it was suggested that a good approach for me today would be to make a statement for the record suggesting or at least contending that the language on page 2, 2, sub 1, sub D, takes actions that it reasonably believes will ensure that no other unauthorized person will have access to the personal information contained in the record, et cetera, is broad enough and wide enough to encompass our current practice in the Providence Health System, and I suspect other hospitals as well, which is to use a bonded third party under contract to us to dispose of personal record information. A question, I suppose, could be asked about whether this bill is broad enough to encompass that. It's possible to construe that the responsibility rests on us and not on a third party we're under contract to. I believe, and our council believes, the language is broad enough, but I wanted to at least make that point for the record. We're also concerned about potential costs if this interpretation is more narrow, because it would require a number of actions of us that we do not now undertake, shredders in every office, et cetera. I guess I would like to, in the final comment, associate myself with the remarks of Mr. Cosgrove in some general way with regard to the penalties provision, as well as the issue others have talked about with regard to a definition of medical business, because I suppose my own office, since I represent a number of healthcare clients, could be construed to be a medical business of the sort described in this bill, and I think that definition can be improved. With that, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, we're willing to work on improvements if that's your desire, and with that, I'll stop and turn to Ms. Bell.
Thank you, Ms. Bell.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jill Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And pretty much I can say me too to what Dave has said. But the other thing that I wanted to mention for the record is that we are now dealing with a new records law on the federal level called HIPAA. And part of that, we are still evaluating the parts of the legislation that rules have actually been made for. And as of right now, there are still more rules to be developed regarding the medical records portion of that act. And I would believe that that addresses all aspects of handling medical records, and we'll be required to work under that. And as part of working with the committee and Senator Brown, if we could maybe make some reference to that, so that that, in fact, is the standard by which we handle medical records, we would be very appreciative of that.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Ackerman.
Yes. As industry representatives, did you think of any form of an exemption to this act if you had an equivalent duty under your internal practices or in compliance with applicable federal law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, yes, we've thought of that, and in fact, having seen language Ms. Leavitt may be prepared to suggest to you that's still at council, I think that language that she has, if she'll allow me to make this comment, I think that language perhaps has applicability in a similar way to others, though it is, in fact, her amendment, and I'm sure she'll share that with you in a moment.
Each of you, I think, did refer to either internal controls or some applicable federal law. Could you tell me what those consist of and if they are sufficient to protect the public in relationship to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I realized this morning when I looked in my office on wheels that I did not have the file I thought I had, which had one of my other clients' records destruction policy. It is, in fact, very similar to Senate Bill 647. It is a company that has branches all over the United States, and so it allows each of the branches to handle it in slightly different ways based on local service availability for shredders and so on, but it requires the institution to the individual office to take responsibility for some mechanism to make sure that when records are destroyed, they are destroyed in a way that they can't be found in a dumpster, either by a third-party shredder or an internal office shredder, depending on how big the office is and if whether that's justified in terms of cost. I apologize for not having it here, but those, I think most institutions have something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman.
Yes,
I know that there are regulations currently that all the hospitals have to use for handling medical records, and it's very detailed and very precise about how it's done, but as far as the details, I would have to get that information for you. I do know also that, as I indicated, HIPAA's the rules are just coming out now, and there's a lot of studying going on in our office by our legal counsel as to what all those regulations require, and so I could get that information as well.
Thank you.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One option might be to consider, if we're looking at amendments on this, some exemption for businesses or services that are otherwise regulated in the manner of the handling and disposal of information, as long as they dispose of it according to those regulations. This then sort of becomes the safety net that catches whatever other businesses might not be particularly regulated, and it seems to me then you wouldn't have the problem of dual regulation then. We'll just say this regulates those businesses that aren't otherwise covered by some other specific regulation already in place on the disposal of records.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, one last comment. I think the virtue of that approach is that it puts us under one regime as to deadlines instead of multiple regimes and with multiple dates and deadlines and effective dates. It just becomes very nearly unmanageable. The goal is the same, destroy records competently.
Can I ask just a question? Do you know what the vote was on the Senate on this bill as it passed over?
Mr. Chair, my recollection without having the file in front of me is it was unanimous.
Did you guys raise any of these issues in the Senate committee before this bill left the Senate?
Chair, I suspected that you might ask us that question. The answer is, for the record and officially, no. With Senator Brown, we did. My client tumbled to the issue after Senate passage in terms of the implications of this with regard to federal HIPAA regulations, and with regard to the possibility that the language might not be broad enough. My interpretation originally of the language on page 2 that I referred to, it was broad enough to encompass our current practice. I guess maybe a bottom line is to suggest that we stand guilty of not raising these issues more effectively in the Senate. I've apologized to Senator Brown for that, and she has been indulgent of our interests in raising these issues both with her and here.
Thank you. Council has just informed me that the vote in the Senate was 29 in favor and one no vote, so almost unanimous.
I reference list of the committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ringo and then Representative Vicki Walker.
Paul, the example you gave of the textbook points through the shredder, that wouldn't give rise to liability in terms of substance abuse, right? The person took a reasonable action,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringo, I think subsection D should be able to cover it, but because of the remedy concern, it would be the subject of a lawsuit, and what would happen is whether a jury agreed that that institution had taken reasonable steps. And that's our concern about the enforcement tied in with the requirements of the bill. We're much more comfortable with our regulators setting up and reviewing our procedures to say if they believe they're reasonable, and then taking into account new developments and new technologies that might make safer.
You would say that action would probably fit within subsection D, and therefore the liability.
Correct.
And I guess all of you on the panel would say that your industry groups and your clients would fall. involved in some sort of deal or not. I think that's what you said. When you're making reasonable attempts to make sure that it's deployed.
Mr. Chair, that's our belief. I suspect that it's subject to interpretation, but that is, in fact, our belief, and we rely on that language. If for no other reason, that's why I'm here today to make these comments. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions of this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Walker.
I think Joe was the first one to bring this up. There's not a pig in this room for you to put money in. So I'm just going to ask you to tell me what the acronym HIPAA stands for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, it's Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Okay. And I believe it was passed in 1997, and we're still doing rules.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Pam Levitt, Dave Nelson, and Julie Brandis, can you come up, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We represent 150 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon. I'm passing out to you the proposed regulation on safeguarding member information. NCUA in the title is the National Credit Union Administration. It is the federal administration that regulates federally chartered credit unions and also insures both state and federally chartered credit unions. In 1999, Congress passed the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and that's otherwise known as our brand new privacy regulation. It encompasses financial institutions and a broad list of individuals dealing with personal information, and Julie's clients also, the retailers, are living under Graham-Leach-Bliley. The regulation goes into effect July of this year, and so we have all been working extremely hard to comply with what we call GLB, Graham-Leach-Bliley. Within Graham-Leach-Bliley came out the Safeguarding Member Information Act, and that is what I gave you a copy of. These regulations, proposed rules, and guidelines are intended to protect the personal information of our members at credit unions and other financial institutions. You can see in the bullet points to ensure the security and confidentiality of member records, protect against anticipated threats and hazards, protect against unauthorized access or use of such records. The regulation goes on to talk about the board's responsibility in monitoring these regulations, the management's responsibility for setting policies and guidelines. It is a very, very strict rule. You should know, and I think Representative Shutterly made our point very accurately, credit unions and all financial institutions are heavily regulated institutions. We have state regulators for our state chartered credit unions in at least every 14 months going through everything. State chartered credit unions are federally insured, and so the federal regulator is also in the financial institution every 14 to 18 months. Same on the federal credit union side. They monitor this. Therefore, they will be following and making sure that this new regulation is enforced. We are taking this new privacy regulation extremely seriously. We are spending thousands and thousands of dollars, and as many of you know who know credit unions, we have very nice large credit unions, but we also have credit unions that are $1 million in asset with one person. They still have to comply with all of these regulations. So our point in Senate Bill 647 is it's certainly an important concept, but we believe that we are already covered, and unfortunately my counsel didn't finish the amendment early enough. It is at LC, and basically it will say everyone who complies with Graham-Leach-Bliley, specifically the Safeguarding Member Information Act, will be deemed covered under Senate Bill 647. Some of you ask about specifics, and I wanted to just talk briefly about what goes on. Prior to the congressional imposed restrictions on privacy and this new regulation, credit unions and all financial institutions have their own policies. We know it is so important to protect your information, and we have established policies that we've had in place for years. I asked several of my credit unions to give me some examples of how they protect information, and I want to just walk you through a specific credit union, and this really represents all of them. This actually comes from Rogue Federal Credit Union. They represent 33,000 members in Jackson County and have $205 million in assets. Basically, they say Rogue Federal Credit Union has always respected and protected member personal information. Graham Leach Bliley requires us now to document and disclose that to the members and to the regulators. Here are some specific points of what they do to protect personal information. The credit union restricts access to personal information to those employees that have specific business purposes. The credit union maintains physical, electronic, and procedural safeguards to protect the personal information. The offices, volunteers, and employees all sign confidentiality requirements. Employees are trained to spot and identify reports of threat to member privacy. Contracts with third parties are signed, and they're required to be as strict as the credit unions on protecting personal privacy. Printed material, including member personal information, is shredded immediately after printout. Account numbers are not shared. All trash is kept located in containers until removed. Printouts are stored in a locked room until shredded in bulk by outside shredding companies. Staff is instructed to keep all personal information out of the view of members, janitors, and contractors. They go on to say, we go way past what is required in Senate Bill 647, and Graham Leach Bliley is much more stringent in these privacy safeguards. We believe, obviously, that we're doing a good job, and this new federal regulation will monitor what we're doing. Just a couple final points. We were not part of the work group, and I apologize that we didn't make more vocal noise on the Senate side. And Senator Brown has been very kind to and be open to accepting the amendment in concept. To the violation section, one thing that one of our members brought up, the Graham Leach Bliley does not have the penalty. Our regulators would be regulating, and there would be not penalties but requirements from the regulator if there was problems. And we believe our agency should be monitoring that, and if there was a violation, it should happen that way instead of under the unlawful trade practice. Someone said to me, if a member walked up to a teller little table out off the teller wall and wrote down some personal information and threw it in a trash can that wasn't deemed one of the you know bins that they shred, you know, they might feel like they're liable under this act. And there wasn't anything in the bill for safe harbor for really the unintentional disposal of information. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I will have the amendment printed, and we really do believe we work extremely hard in all of our credit unions to protect your personal information, and we believe that both the federal and state regulators will be monitoring this, and Senate Bill 647 should not apply to federally insured institutions.
Hey, we're going to have to kind of pick up the pace. We've got another issue we have to deal with before 9:30. It's obvious we're going to have to look at some amendments with Kate Brown. So if the other two of you could just give us a kind of a quick brief overview.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and the Retail Council. Our retail members include some of the nation's largest retailers, and they also offer credit. We would like to see an exemption. I think, Pam, first of all, Ms. Levitt has explained that Graham Leach Bliley does apply to many of our retailers who offer credit, and to provide the exemption that Pam has talked about, or to provide the exemption that Representative Shetterly has talked about, those companies that are already regulated under more stringent federal law, that would be very helpful. We would also like to see an exception for records transferred in the normal course of business. We have members who have credit card operations, but they're not owned by the company, the retail company. We are concerned that the retailer may be held liable for copies of records we may have been using that the actual company that offers the financial credit has disposed of. We certainly appreciate Senator Brown's legal interpretation, but our attorneys are saying that is not clearly accepted within the proposed legislation. In respect to identity theft, I know there's a time shortage, but I would just recommend to legislators, and we at AOI are certainly willing to help, this is a huge issue, and there are 10 or 12 steps that we recommend to people to protect your identity from being stolen. The unfortunate part, as Representative Walker, and personally I can testify to, is once your identity is stolen, it's too late. And there are prevention ways you can prevent or catch it early in the act. Another great horror story, those of you who know Brian Doherty, he has had a horrible situation where he exists as another person right now in Puerto Vallarta, but even though he might be in the building, the other Brian Doherty is in Puerto Vallarta. And there are things that I think as legislators, you can take the time with your communications to say prevent identity theft before it happens and communicate to them about running accurate credit checks upon yourself to make sure somebody hasn't accessed your credit. Make sure that you are shredding your own material as it leaves your home. Make sure you do not keep your Social Security card in your wallet. If you have, Joe Bell will probably grab me by the neck behind me, but or the insurance companies. But if your name and so if you have a health card, I could pull out my health card, and it says Julie Brandis, and then it also says your number. And generally, that number, your group number, or your ID number, is your Social Security number. Just black that out. When you turn it into the hospital or you go to the doctors, you can tell them your number. You should know your Social Security number by heart. But what most people don't understand is if you drop your ID card, a lot of people can start to tie that. That's a Social Security number. So those are things we can do. We can educate our own constituents about protecting your identity, because the thing is you have to do it before it happens and to continue to find ways to protect it within law as well.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, formerly known as the Oregon Life Underwriters Association. We have about 1,500 members statewide, and our association members estimate that they write about three-quarters of the life and health insurance business that's written in the state of Oregon. We are subject to Graham Leach Bliley. We appreciate Senator Brown's suggestion that those regulated by Graham Leach Bliley could be exempted from this process. There are three bills currently working their way through the through this legislative session, Senate Bill 267, 268, and 269, that implement Graham-Leach-Bliley in the state of Oregon. The insurance industry generally has not been subjected to regulation under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We'd like to keep it that way. We encourage our members, and all of them generally have processes that are intended to guard very closely the security of their clients as attorneys or accountants or anyone else would, and go to great lengths to do that. So I think in the interest of time, as the chair suggested, I'll stop there and say we would like to work with the chair of the committee on any amendments that may be drafted along the line.
Mr. Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brand, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the retail folks who issue credit cards. My concern is with retail establishments, period. When you pay with a credit card for something, there are still some who have the carbon paper between the two instead of the NCR paper. I always ask for that if they have carbon paper, and I take it home and throw it in my fireplace. But I'm concerned that we're not talking about those people in the bill, and I think there should be an obligation upon a retail person to dispose of those records.
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, we understand that depending on your retail establishment, depending on how big you are, depending on if you're a national retailer, the way you use credit, whether you use carbon or not, is certainly an issue. This bill addresses a very small portion of industry, and it was much broader in the Senate and was tightened down, I believe, from what I remember from seeing the original bill. There are lots of industries that are not covered in this bill. There are many attorneys here on this committee, and I would argue that my attorney who manages my family's will has much more personal information about me than any retailer ever has. And they're not included in this act, again. So what I'm saying is this act is specific to certain industries. It is not a broad-based act.
That was my question. Why not?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't know. I didn't draft it.
Yeah.
I wasn't even in the
I'll
work group.
I'll ask that question
so.
To Senator Brown. Thank you.
Representative Shetterly?
Just a comment. Julie, this, I think your attorney probably is covered by it because I would imagine most lawyers' offices have medical information in their files, and this seems to apply to the business and not to the records. So if you've got a business that contains medical records, then this doesn't seem to be specific to those records. It's all records. So it's just interesting.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. It's obvious they got some work to do in the beginning with getting together with the staff. Senator Brown, I'll close a public hearing on the bill, and we're going to move over to work session on Senate Bill 220, and we're going to give a Wes, is it Ettinger?
Ettinger.
Ettinger, would you come up, Wes, please?
While he's coming up, members of the committee, Senate Bill 220, we had a visit from Senator Courtney on this bill. It's his bill, and we had some testimony about it in the civil subcommittee. Because we have collapsed the committee since then, we did not have a carrier for this bill, and I don't believe there's any amendments to it. So actually, I don't think we had any other testimony besides Senator Courtney. So.
Wes, could you state your name? And
my name is Wes Ettinger, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon School Activities Association. This bill actually is one that we have done a lot of research on. It's a bill that, for some reason, back in the early 80s, the law changed some way, and we've gone through all the archives to check it out, and there's no reason why we should have to go through a circuit court before we go to the appeals court. And basically what this would do is eliminate that step. No other nonprofit organization or organization of our kind has to do that. When you go to the hearings officer with the State Department of Ed, it's a full-fledged hearing, and I don't know what you call it in legal terms, but basically, all other groups can go directly to the appeals court, but in our process, for some reason, it's spelled out that we have to take that step through circuit court, and it's an added expense for us and time, and so that's why we've proposed this.
Okay, anyone have any questions for Mr. Ettinger?
Mr. Chair?
I have a question.
Oh, Shetterly, she has a question. I was going to make a motion.
I think Representative Shetterly was ahead of. Oh, you were going to move
it? I was going to move it, yeah.
Actually, this is possibly a question for Andrea. Did you look at the legislative history? I'm just curious here where I'm reading in the staff summary that there was no, where was it, unclear why the change was made in 1993?
I personally didn't do any research. I think Marilyn O'Dell did that, and that was also based on what the OSAA finding was, but I didn't go check the archives or figure it out.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Wes, just for my information, how many court cases have there been? I think in recent times there have been more, I would assume, than some years ago. Is that true? Or?
By, Chairman Krieger and Representative Backlund, I can't give you that figure right off, but we've had a number of hearings. Most of our things do not go to court. Most of them are stopped during the hearings process, but we've had quite a number in the 8 years that I've been there that we've gone through the hearings.
And committee members, my perception is, having been a high school coach for 37 years, my perception is, as I've read and talked to others, and that there have been a considerable increase in court cases in general, and I think this is a good bill, and it's not real important. I wouldn't lay awake at night worrying about it, but note that it's sponsored by Senator Courtney and by Representative Backlund, and so I would say that in passing.
Right, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, I guess before I make a motion too, it seems to me that a lot of these disputes have an element of timeliness about them too, and it would seem that extra level of review at the circuit court before the Court of Appeals would just delay the inevitable outcome. One way, most important in a dispute like this is to get it decided. And it doesn't help much if the sophomore is graduated from high school by the time the Court of Appeals finishes with the case on determining eligibility. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to move Senate Bill 222 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Reverend Shetterly has moved Senate Bill 228 to the floor with direct due pass recommendation. Any objections? Clerk, do you want to call the roll?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative
Dinkfelder? Aye.
Representative
Bingo?
Excuse.
Representative
Shetterly? Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Nikki Walker?
Aye.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruiser?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowell?
She's excused. Excuse.
The bill moves to the floor. Representative Backlund, you want to carry it?
Be happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, he did, although I just see this.
I can't remember now what it was.
This is 2? We weren't doing 2877.
We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 925A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 925, we heard about in the civil subcommittee a couple weeks ago, I guess, or last week, and it deals with intoxicated persons and what type of suit they can file. And it, we didn't have a carrier on this one. I don't know if somebody from the committee, we only had testimony from Bill Perry from the Oregon Restaurant Association in the civil sub.
Any of the members recall any testimony on this other than that? Bill who?
Perry.
You know who. Mm-hmm. Wonder who that might be.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll just. Do you want to? You want to know more about? You weren't in on the subcommittee hearing on this. Okay.
No. I have something in my file that Mr. Perry gave me.
Well, is Mr. Chair that if I can, both Bill can state it as much as any. But I think what this says is that for the purpose of dram shop liability or host liability that. If you've got somebody who voluntarily, and I think that's an important word in the bill, voluntarily consumes alcohol and then goes out and as a consequence of their intoxication injures themselves or causes harm to themselves, even in the bill, up to death, that... the host, the provider, is not liable for that person's own injuries. So it's a narrowing of the dram shop liability. I think it's worth pointing out again that this doesn't apply to injuries that are caused to third parties. So if that person goes out and is in an automobile accident and kills or injures somebody else, that business owner or host is still going to be liable to the third party. Nor does it apply to claims for relief based on damages or intentional acts other than the service of alcohol. So I guess if you've got somebody who's visibly intoxicated, leaves a premises, and then going out the premises falls through a defective stair and injures themselves, then the premises liability will still kick in separate from damages as a result of intoxication. So. It's fairly narrow and I think appropriate to the case for somebody who is, again, in the language of the bill, voluntarily, has voluntarily consumed alcohol.
have a question if I could.
Go ahead, Walker.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly, if, so here's the scenario that I've got in my mind. You're in a bar drinking. The bartender does not cut you off when you are visibly intoxicated, which I think there's some liability there. But anyway, you get in your own car and you drive home and you smash your car and you die. Your estate cannot sue the bar. Is
right.
that what this bill would do?
That would be the effect of it.
So there's no liability on the part of the bartender to stop serving you alcohol at some point?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. I would bet that in most cases this is not a problem because I would expect that the bar owner is going to be a lot more concerned about your risk of harm to third parties, third persons. So this is not going to create an incentive for bar owners to serve people in an intoxicated state.
Right.
Clearly it's not, because the greater risk is they're going to go out and hurt somebody else, in which case then the bar owner is still going to be liable. But I think to the extent that this recognizes some element of personal responsibility for damages that you caused to yourself through your own voluntary intoxication, I think it's a fair balancing.
We had a pretty good discussion on that.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I just wanted to ask those
clarify
questions
it.
And clarify it in my own mind. And I think generally when people go out drinking and driving, they do kill others and injure others rather than themselves. They're so drunk they don't feel it, but I think that's fair. So
further
I
comments?
Appreciate the explanation.
Representative Dinkfeller?
Yes, and I did not, this hearing happened before I arrived here at the legislature, so there are some notes in my file, but I wanted to see if there was anybody in just at least or I missed that hearing.
No, it was in the civil subcommittee.
There are notes. These aren't my notes, and maybe the Representative Bowman's notes are here.
They might be from your assistant, because he came and talked to me, I think, about the bill. That's possible. John?
Okay. Because I was going to ask if there was anybody who testified in opposition.
No.
There was no testimony that opposed.
Okay. That makes sense.
Any further comments?
Thank you.
Just a general comment. I know when this bill started out, it was a very contentious issue. I guess I've been informed that all the stakeholders in this have pretty much resolved this. I don't see anyone testifying to that today, but that's my understanding. I don't know if any members of the committee have any other view on that.
Mr. Perry, if I couldn't, Mr. Chairman, no, you keep the gavel, that's fine, but I believe Mr. Perry is here from the Restaurant Association, and if it makes Representative Ackerman comfortable, perhaps we could have Mr. Perry comment on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Perry from the Oregon Restaurant Association. There were two issues that were raised. One of them is there was a concern not to affect the two cases that are in current court, and that's why it does not apply to those two. The other one was brought forth by the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and the subject that Representative Shetterly brought up very effectively is if there was a ripped carpet, broken stair, broken handrail, they still wanted premise liability. And so that's due to the A-A amendments, is once we added those, they wanted to make sure that that was comfortable and they would pull their opposition. So nobody, to my knowledge, has expressed any opposition to me outside of those two examples that have been corrected in the bill.
Thank you. That's my understanding, too.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Bill. Someone like to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm Vice Chair. I'll let you be Chair.
I'll move Senate Bill 925A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The bill has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Backlund? Aye.
Representative
Backlund? Aye. Representative
Dinkfelder? Aye.
Representative
Ringo? Excuse.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Krieger? Aye. Vice Chair Lowe? Excuse.
Chair
Williams?
Aye.
Senate Bill 925 moves to the floor with the recommendation. Who would want to carry the bill? Want to carry it? Representative Vicki Walker. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 925. And our business is done for the day.
It is.
Thank you.
Wow. Pretty good, huh?
Sure.